Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that sometimes confront, intersect, and interrupt our daily lives. Sarah Allen Benton's book, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle, is a guide for parents working to raise children while maintaining a sober lifestyle. Benton blends her personal journey with her expertise as a licensed mental health and addiction specialist to address the unique challenges that recovery can bring into the family. The book addresses how sobriety affects parenting styles, emotional resilience, relationships, and the digital pressures modern parents face. Benton provides insights into establishing a healthy, sober family life by focusing on values, connection, and support network. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Sarah Allen Benton, I welcome you to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to talking with you. I read your book and I thought, you know, it was just full of really valuable information. First of all, I asked, did I do justice to your book? Did I accurately depict what was in it? Was it an accurate overview of your book? Or what would you add?
It was. I mean, it's almost like I know I wrote the book, but I can't fully take credit for the wisdom in the pages because there's over 400 years of recovery from parents in recovery that are reflected in the pages from interviews I did. And then also addiction experts, some research, my own personal, you know, journal writings. But I just, for me, the heart of the book is the experiences that those parents in recovery I interviewed were vulnerable enough and wise enough to share with others.
Well, what inspired you to write Parents in Recovery?
Well, I'd say my own being a parent in recovery myself, but I hadn't really fully conceptualized what that meant. I always knew that there were things I did that were a little different maybe than other parents, or I felt a little different in some ways. And then I was actually in a bookstore one day and I was in the memoir section and this book called Mother Noise by Cindy House jumped out at me, picked it up. And on the inside flap, she was talking about the quote unquote telling to her 11-year-old son and confused about that her son knew she was sober but didn't know about her past and how you can feel disconnected from your children when you have this whole history of why you don't use substances, but they don't necessarily know the reason and when and, you know, what age is appropriate to talk to them about that. Mm-hmm. And it captured me. And, you know, it's actually relevant to this age group, right? Mm-hmm. The tweens and teens. And my daughter was about that age when I saw that book cover. And so I walked out, I bought the book and I walked out and I had thought to myself, you know, there's memoirs about, you know, mothers in recovery, things like that. But is there anything for parents in recovery? So I started doing research and I realized there really wasn't much out there. And it just was like that kind of aha moment that this is, you know, this is needed. And I really think this is my calling to write this.
And I think that's what made your book really unique, because I also did a little research and there's very little information out there about parents in recovery. So it was definitely timely. Can you share?
It's odd. I mean, I like finding what's missing and kind of filling those gaps. And mm-hmm. I was surprised at that. You know, it's interesting because I kind of wrote what I wish I had. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that mm-hmm. I had that kind of field guide.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of, well, share a bit about your journey, I guess, as an addiction and mental health counselor and how that shaped your approach to the book.
It's interesting because I felt I felt like I was able to write this book from two perspectives, mm-hmm. both that of a person who specializes in treating clients with substance use disorders, and also as a person in long-term recovery. So that was really, it gave me a lot within my, you know, experience, and also personal, like I wasn't just talking about it intellectually, right? Sure. I had an emotional connection to the topic as well, but I was able to be objective when I needed to be. So it was pretty powerful because I also saw how this book could be used clinically, like in group therapy. Mm-hmm. I also saw that this book could be a resource for like relatives of parents in recovery, for parents themselves. Like my mother actually read the book, and she's, you know, she knows a lot about what I've been through in my recovery and as a parent and stuff. But it was interesting because she said she really felt like she didn't actually understand the experience truly until she read the book. And it caught me off guard because I thought, you know, I thought I'd communicated it through the years, but just all the different layers and all the different areas and domains of our lives that are impacted by both our substance use and also our recovery and our family systems.
Mm-hmm. How does a parent's sobriety influence their parenting approach? You know, there are unique challenges that they encounter. So would you, you know, address that?
Sure. I think it impacts every aspect of the way that we parent. And I know this only because I've had my own experience. And then I got to talk to all these other parents and kind of compare stories in a sense and notes. And what I noticed is different themes. I'd say one of them is making sure that we teach our children coping skills and emotion regulation skills that maybe we didn't feel we had when we were growing up, that we give them the things we learned in our recovery when we felt like, why didn't we learn this stuff when we were younger, right? Mm-hmm. Why did it take us to have a substance use disorder and have consequences and get help to learn these things? So one of the themes I've definitely noticed is wanting to kind of get ahead of the curve and having our kids really more in tune with their emotions and have maybe even getting into therapy earlier on, mm-hmm. Just an openness to their process of seeking support. It doesn't have to be for substances, but just mm-hmm. in general with dealing with life in a healthy manner, or if we see budding mental health issues that we tend to want to address it. I think it can go the other way where there's a level of like worry and anxiety that, oh my gosh, yeah. You know, with the genetic component, does my daughter or my son have addictive personality, mm-hmm. right? Or impulsive behaviors. And then you start overanalyzing the things that maybe all kids do, but yeah. for some reason you think your kid is the one that's like, oh my God, I'm gonna be an addict or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. so I know, and what was interesting is I had this other group of parents that I interviewed that were, they weren't guinea pigs, but they were like a control group. So they were parents that were not in recovery. They, you know, they drank and maybe used substances like recreationally. And they didn't have the same level of worry that the parents in recovery did.
Okay.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting because I mm-hmm. kind of thought a lot of I thought every parent sort of had that in the back of their mind. But when I did a sort of scaling, I just noticed it was a different level of concern. Yeah.
Well, share with the audience. I think it's important. You touched on this, exactly why you think it is important for children to know about their parents' addiction.
And this, you know, and this was really, this question was answered so differently by all the different people that I, there were a lot of different answers. There was no one right answer. When did you tell your child uh-huh. about your history or why you don't drink or why you don't use substances? It's usually alcohol because that's the most obvious one that you wouldn't be doing kind of socially in a sense. I think that probably comes up the most. And what I found was that there were a group of parents who really, they brought their kids to self-help meetings and they were very open, and it was just a huge part of their culture in their family. And they were just, they just kind of threw it around. Like, it was very casual. Mm-hmm. I don't know that the kids at a young age could really fully conceptualize what it meant. And then there was a group of parents that decided they would prefer to wait, and they had fear around, like, when they told their children, you know, were they giving them ideas? Were they condoning it in some way? Were they giving them permission? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. would they think differently? Would your children think differently of you after they hear about your past? And what the conclusion I've come to really, if I, from a clinical perspective, like as a therapist, I don't think there's like a right age to say it, but I think there is an age in which you should, by the time they are exposed in their social community to alcohol and drugs, I do believe you should have had that conversation by then, mm-hmm. because the genetic component is so powerful. It accounts for 50% the chance of developing it. And you can actually support them in giving them the empowerment and knowledge about, if you delay your onset of drinking alcohol in particular to the age of 15, you can decrease their chance by 40% regardless of their family history of developing an alcohol use disorder. And every year that they delay, I think the chances decreased about 7%. So you're basically trying to set them up for success. You're telling them about a genetic condition, like if they had diabetes or cancer in their family, there are some things that we do, right? That we look at, that we measure, that we maybe screen earlier. And so I think that those pieces are important at a certain point from a safety perspective for our children to know.
Okay. Communication. What I gleaned from your book, communication is very important with children, with friends, with family. Did you find that to be the case? And if so, I'm not going to expect you to answer this because we're going to take a break in a few seconds, but I just wanted to pose this question. How does one open communication about sobriety with children? I mean, are there age-appropriate ways to discuss it? And you kind of touched on this, is there an appropriate time to tell them? Do you have to worry about them being too young? I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts, but that's what we're going to deal with after we take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Let me introduce my guest. Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery, is a licensed advanced alcohol and drug counselor, addiction counselor, and mental health counselor. She's been a parent in recovery from alcoholism for more than 18 years. Sarah, right before we went on break, I was asking you just about the communication and when is the opportune time to communicate sobriety and when you do it, and wanted to get you to respond to, I guess, first, how does one open communication about sobriety with children?
What's interesting is that just by saying that you're sober or you don't use substances doesn't, you know, like in my daughter's case, she didn't actually know. She knew why she didn't know the real why. She knew it was, we said, for health reasons, mm-hmm. right? So she's always known that. And I mean, if your child is comparing themselves to other parents who drink and maybe smoke pot here and there or whatever's going on, they see that you're a little different, right? So there's some pieces of it that it's just obvious to them. Mm-hmm. For me, it was about the why. That's the part that I kind of held from her. And I have friends that didn't hold that from their children. They decided mm-hmm. to be more transparent around the why. For me, I thought the why was a bit unnecessary, or that she was too young to really understand what that meant. But there, I don't think there's any age where it's not appropriate to say that you intentionally don't have substances in your house. You know, I mean, there's, I don't know what harm could come from that. Obviously, we've been, you know, at parties and events where there is alcohol. And it's interesting. My daughter's even had children say to her, "You're lucky that your parents don't drink." And again, she didn't
Really?
always know why. And they would see the personality change. My daughter was actually really uncomfortable around parents that were drinking too much because she wasn't used to seeing that transformation. And in fact, I actually thought that kids whose parents drank regularly would have a little bit more immunity or exposure or just sort of obliviousness to their parents drinking. But in fact, they have made comments. It's just interesting to me. Like, I think that when people have a drink and it's not notable, it's not notable. But when there are personality changes that come around, it can sometimes, for certain children, be a little bit scary and unpredictable and feel a little bit unsafe for them. So the why, I think there was never a question about, and I don't think there ever should be about, we don't drink. Like, okay, you know, for health reasons. I think it's the why and how much data do you back that up with, right? Like, okay, so you had a problem. I mean, how many details have I gotten into? And I think that's the part that over time you gauge based on your comfort level, the type of child that you have, right? I don't think there's a one size fits all explanation of it. But I do think that you should consider the temperament of your child. Also, you know, how you can state it without getting into the entire, because some of our histories are a little bit more sordid than others. And you know, you don't, I mean, even if you're not in recovery, there are certain things you don't share with your children. It's just a boundary, right? So that's part of it too. But really, it was for me about telling her, you know, I really want to sit down and explain to you about why, because I know you know that mommy and daddy don't drink or use substances, right? Like, she knew that already. It was about the why.
Well, do you think, and I know it really is, it depends on the child and the maturity level and, you know, the relationship with you and how comfortable one, the parent feels about it. But do you ever think that children are too young for an honest conversation about the substance use disorder? I mean, are there age-appropriate ways to discuss it that you would recommend to the listening audience?
I definitely think that there's different ways you could do it that it would be more relatable. Because I think that the concept is almost, if I think about like a 5, a 6, a 7, an 8, a 9, a 10-year-old versus like a tween or a teen, I think that the discussion would be framed differently. I also think that one of the, you know, to be honest, one of the pathways to this topic was through the topic of electronics and my daughter's phone. That's really how I found a comfort level in speaking to her, because we've always, and I think this is an important topic for all kids, but I've had a sensitivity to how to her use of phones, to the amount of dopamine that it kind of sets off and the impact on attention span and all of that. So I think there's addictive qualities to a phone. So I've always spoken about the phone as something that has addictive potential. Like, it can make things that are, you know, like reading, it can make it less interesting or your attention span's shorter. So I've used the phone as a bit of a gateway into that conversation. And the reason I knew she was ready was one day she said, or one weekend, she felt like she had used it too much, and said, "I felt like almost like addicted to it." And she used that word. And I felt like she kind of got the concept. And so I felt like she was ready. And so I think there's ways to use things like food or your phone or just other activities to discuss what is it when your brain needs more or when you don't have a shut off, right? Like, those things are present in our kids' lives, whether it's a substance or not. And those choices, right? And those, the impact and the, so it, I think I had already been in a way priming that conversation through phone, through the topic of electronics.
How do you foster an environment for the children, an emotionally secure, I guess, environment for the children who may be coping with their parents' recovery journey? How does a parent foster that environment?
Well, and that's an interesting question because some of the people interviewed got sober after they had children. Some of them got sober before. Some of them were single parents. And some of them had children before they got sober and after. So there were all these different combinations, right? I think that I know for one of the parents that that I interviewed, she had teenage daughters, and they were aware of her alcoholism. And so when she got sober, she felt like if I drank in front of them and they saw that, then they deserved to see my recovery and to hear about it. And so she decided to have an open, you know, conversation, you know, this it's 10 o'clock. It's, you know, it's time. It's my meeting time. Like she would start to have that self-care conversation. And this is what, you know, I need to do for my recovery. And so it was sharing that experience with them actually gave them peace of mind because they felt like the more time she invested, the more likely it would be that she'd be successful in staying sober. So they were her biggest cheerleaders. In other cases, the parents, one of the parents interviewed, her daughter, one of them wasn't born yet, but the other was so young that she would never have a recollection of her use. However, she is sober and her husband isn't. And so he's like a normie, as we would call it, like a normal drinker. And she still has been able to find, you know, the certain things that she does and prioritizes for her recovery. And so they have an experience of having one parent, you know, with these different things they need to do for their recovery, whereas the other parent doesn't. And I mean, if you think about it, when you have different types of medical conditions or different types of mental health conditions, there are things that you do and adjust, right, around that. And it's kind of similar with recovery. There are things that we, and that were themes I'm sure that you noticed throughout the book, of all these different little things that people would do. And that sharing that, the reasoning for that with our children can be a gift because like my daughter, sometimes I'll be like, all right, like, what's going on? You don't want to talk, or just joking around. And she's like, my social battery is drained. So it's like, she's right. There's certain language of limits, right? Like, you know, it's okay to have downtime and to not be go, go, go and balance and, you know, just spiritual pursuits and religious pursuits and all these things that you integrate into your family. You don't have to be in recovery to integrate those things. But what I do notice is they're not up for debate in the families that have longer term recovery. It's not optional. And when those things slip, it can result in not necessarily just a relapse, but emotional sobriety is a really important concept. I love the term actually, because I think it says so much, but when you stop and put the substance down, you're left with your emotions and with, right? So you can be not using, but have your emotional sobriety be off the beam, right? So that's one of the goals, is how do we keep ourselves centered? And it's hard. I mean, being a parent, it's right. There's selfless pieces of it. There's scheduling insanity. There's all kinds of things that come up, but you know, what is it that you do to keep yourself in some type of a centered state or have the supports and people to talk to? And sometimes you don't want to necessarily rely on your children to be that support, but letting them in on your journey. I mean, that's like living, it's a living example, right? Of taking care of yourself.
Yeah. And it gives them some insight. They need to have a framework to understand what's going on. So,
right.
Yeah. And not only with your children, but you're talking about extended family, partners. How do you create, or what role do they play? Because they can help or they can hinder. And we're not talking about children here now. We're talking about the partners or the extended grandparents, aunts, uncles. How can they help or hinder the recovery?
Do put the responsibility on to the person in recovery to be asking for delegating, asking for support, letting people know what their needs are. Because I do think one of the issues is family not knowing what you need, right? Mm-hmm. So you can sit there feeling sorry for yourself and they keep doing this and they keep doing that and you don't say anything. So I do want to put the onus on the parents in recovery that they also need to start to learn what they do need, what support is helpful. The people pleasing has to end at a certain point, you know, not wanting other people to be uncomfortable all the mm-hmm. time, because these things can happen, right? Where you start to just get into this, like, stuff it down and don't say what you need. I do know that, you know, at least for the first 90 days, it is important to have a substance-free home. And it's really helpful when family members, and again, there's extended family members that live with different people, right? Like mm-hmm. we have all different family systems that live in different, and friends that live together. But having that safe space at home is really important, at least for the first 90 days and ideally for the first year. There are some people that will never have substances in their house, but it really depends on your partner, right? It depends on who you're living with. So that's the immediate family. But there's also, you know, who's supporting you when you need to attend a self-help meeting or go to therapy, mm-hmm. or you just need to tap out, right? And you really just need somebody to take the reins for a bit. Like, how do you communicate that, right? Is there mm-hmm. a system in place, or is that totally catching somebody off guard? So some of it is scheduling, right? Some mm-hmm. of it is baking mm-hmm. it into your schedule. I know, like, my husband and I have this thing where we use the Google Calendar and anything that the other person needs to know that would be kind of outside the normal hours of, like, work or something, we'll invite the other person so the other person knows. So if, like, you're going to a meeting or you're going to exercise or something like that, so that there isn't double booking. So I think every family kind of needs to come up with their own system. Right. But the extended family, and it's different with every family, right? What role they play. Sometimes it's that you see them, you know, once or twice a year for, you know, the holidays are coming up, and, you know, not everybody has to rotate their life around your recovery. So I think there's a piece of it where, you know, we don't want to get crazy on it. Right. But at the same time, if it's, you know, every weekend you're having, you know, dinner at your, you know, parents' house or grandparents' house, and there's, you mm-hmm. know, just it's waterfall of wine flowing down the wall, right?
Exactly.
Like, I mean, I think that then you can, like, it makes sense to say, like, you know, I'm either not going to be able to attend, or I'd love to hang out and do something during the day when it's not alcohol fueled. Mm-hmm. I think that the holidays are an interesting time where people have to find, you know, maybe you only stay for a half hour instead of three. Like, mm-hmm. there's all these different tricks. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people gave those suggestions in my book of, like, ways to kind of navigate those social interactions. But it does fall on us to be honest about our limits. And sometimes the limits change, which I really ask people to be honest with yourself. Like, sometimes you'll make a plan and you're like, oh, I'm fine going to that party, because we can go to parties that have, like, alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. Like, not everybody does, but you can, right? And it's, why are you there? Are you there mm-hmm. to celebrate your friend's birthday? But what if you wake up that day, you're feeling exhausted, you're feeling burnt, you know, mm-hmm. the candles burnt at both ends, and you feel vulnerable. And you're like, you know what? This isn't a good night for me to go. You can change your mind, right? Yeah. Like, it may have been a good idea a week ago, but you're just not up for it, and it's not going to work. And getting used to, you know, people are used to, in my life, if I'm like, I'm just, you know what, I just need some downtime. That's the answer.
Okay.
There doesn't have to be an excuse and a made up this. Mm-hmm. It can just be, I need to just recalibrate. I've overextended this week and I need to chill. And over time, people get that answer. It doesn't, you don't have to make up a lie, you know?
Yeah. And you kind of touched on this. I wish, you know, I was nodding my head, but I'm thinking about that parent in recovery who has a partner that says they're supportive and they do try to be supportive, but they resent the changes that have to occur within that home. Do you have any suggestions as to how they navigate them? They resent the changes of, I know some will go to not having any alcohol in the home, or don't want alcohol in the home, or don't want to be in an environment where there is alcohol or, you know, marijuana or whatever, because they feel like they're not ready for that. Do you have any suggestions of how they should navigate that?
Yeah, I do. First of all, there's a parallel process going on where the person in recovery has got their supports. But what about the person that's not in recovery that mm-hmm. now is witnessing all of these shifts and changes with their loved one, right? What
right.
about them?
Yeah.
Because there is a selfishness, right? Here we are. We have the person that's like, you know, they had an addiction. They were like, whatever was going on. Now they're in recovery and everybody's got to rotate around that.
Right.
So what I really encourage is that the loved ones also get their own support. And, you know, there's actually a book called Love Without Martinis, How Couples Build Healthy Relationships in Recovery. And it's by Chantal Jauvin. And it's really an interesting niche, because it's for the loved one who didn't need to get sober, but their partner did, and how it changes that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because there are people that actually, they enjoy drinking with their partner, but they didn't drink alcoholically. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So,
but the other person took it to the next level, right?
Right.
So, they miss that time they used to have.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
In that carefree state and on their Friday night, you know, mm-hmm. dinners. And they can't do that anymore because their partner just can't, right? Has an issue.
Hold your thoughts. I hate to interrupt
sure.
you, but
oh,
hold
sure.
your thoughts right here. We'll get back to you in a brief minute. We're going to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and parents and educators. And this edition of 411 Teen is talking with Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery. Sarah, I had to interrupt you. Would you continue your thoughts?
In addition, there's also social support for the loved ones, and that comes in the form of, you know, since the pandemic, there's a lot of access to different recovery mediums that we didn't have before by virtual. Everything used to be in person, and now you can access groups in different countries. You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. So, you know, something like She Recovers, they have started in Canada. That's all recovery. So it can be recovery from codependency, like with a partner that had addiction that you know, like trauma. There's Al-Anon and Alateen. There's Nar-Anon. Then mm-hmm. there's CARES groups. It's like C period, A period, R period, E period, S period. And there's Learn to Cope, Learn with a 2, Cope mm-hmm. groups. And now, I mean, a lot of these groups that used to be in more isolated areas, or, you know, one of those groups was just in Massachusetts. Now, you know, they've got virtual meetings. So there's more access to those things. So mm-hmm. I do encourage social support, not just for the person that identified, you know, person in recovery, but also for their family members, because then you get to meet other people that are going through the same experience. It's also important to consider, if you don't want to do it, you know, publicly, going to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest with an addiction specialist, because they really get the process of recovery. It is a specialization in my field. Not everybody's trained to work with clients or family members with addictive issues. So I do recommend finding a specialist.
Okay.
And, you know, again, I think it's also asking for support even from your loved one. So if your loved one is in recovery, it's also about, you know, communicating with them and having a reciprocal relationship around who needs what, because it's not all about the person in recovery.
You've touched a little bit on this, but I wanted to ask you, how does digital exposure impact recovery, especially regarding to mental health and stress?
I find this to be a fascinating topic, and mm-hmm. I felt like I couldn't write this book without addressing this particular topic, just given how much of an influence it has on our lives. There's a lot of different components to it. I would say that, well, first, there's kind of the surface level where social media allows us to glimpse into people's lives, right, in a way that maybe we couldn't before. And in some ways, I think everybody is their best PR agent, and they're putting out these, you know, images of how wonderful things are going. And in early sobriety, it can be hard sometimes for individuals and parents alike to look at other people's night out and pictures and this and that. And maybe they had a social circle they used to spend time with, but now they're not because they needed to take a break. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain self-imposed torture that people do to themselves by sitting there and looking at all of this, right? And this yes. fear of missing out, or this FOMO uh-huh. sets in.
FOMO. So,
FOMO, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, in those cases, and I've had to talk with many, many, you know, clients about this and friends in recovery, that that's on us again, right? We have mm-hmm. to take responsibility of what we feed into our consciousness. And is that a healthy thing? How do you feel when you get off of, you know, some of those social media sites? Do you feel better about yourself, worse about mm-hmm. yourself? Like, what do you feel mm-hmm. like? So I do think that there need to be parameters set for those that are heavily affected by it. That's kind of on the surface level, but on a deeper level, there's the dopamine response. And I think, and I know that Anne Lemke wrote Dopamine Nation, mm-hmm. which is a book that I quote. And there's a movie called The Social Dilemma, which I also quote in my book. And I found them both to be really powerful on this topic, that there is a certain pleasure center priming effect that our phones have, and a lot of social media in particular, with the likes and the comments and the notifications, are designed to get that dopamine going. Uh-huh. And for a person that's in recovery or that has addictive tendencies, they're sometimes more susceptible to those pleasure center responses. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, everyone's susceptible in some ways. Right. I think our phones are probably exactly. One of the most addictive things in our lives. But I think even more so, especially those that are in early sobriety, that their brain is just sitting there fiending to glom onto something, right? So yeah. it's easy. And I mean, it could be worse, right? It could right. be worse. But over time, it's kind of like sweets. A lot of people in early recovery will be like, I have to have my sweets. Okay, but is this like 10 years later, you're still, right? Like, so at what point do you start to say, you know what, like, I need to check myself over here. I need mm-hmm. to maybe look at my screen time or take this app off because it's just not feeding anything good into my recovery. So those are, I just think there's a lot there. And mm-hmm. I think as far as the teen brain and what I was talking about before on that conversation with even my daughter on framing of phone use, is that it can affect and be so stimulating that it sets off addictive properties or like pleasure center parts of our brain. And then it can prime for other addictive behaviors for those that are more prone to impulsive or even some video games, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about you have to establish parameters or, you know, boundaries. Do you have some suggestions and strategies for finding a balance in setting these boundaries and then finding a balance with the social media? I mean, I don't know if I said that clearly, but I think I did. You know, what I'm asking is, are there strategies that you can share for setting parameters or boundaries and then finding that balance within the social media?
I think that's always the objective, mm-hmm. but it's not always possible. And I think that people need to consider what apps and what things are able to moderate versus those things that the minute they use it, it sets something off in their brain and they just can't stop, you know? And being honest about that, much like the shutoff with substances, there are some apps that are just, they're just designed to hook people. And recognizing that is so important, along with knowing your own limits. I think that's, you know, there's some that I take off my phone, you know, it's just,
that's it.
But others, I'm like, it's not that interesting. So it's all good. But you have to recommit here and there.
Yeah.
To assessing.
Okay. Yeah. You touched on a little bit emotional resilience, and I wanted to get back to that. How can parents in recovery build emotional resilience and coping mechanisms for handling stress without turning to past habits?
It is the million-dollar question. There's a rewiring that goes on, and some of it's around our reward system. Like how, after a hard week of work, what do we do for ourselves? Or why are we overscheduling, stressing ourselves out, and then needing a substance to check out? So what happens in the recovery process is you don't just stop using. You evaluate your entire life and all of its domains over time, and you create a life that doesn't require substances to survive.
The community, and, you know, I'm talking about the community that that individual with an SUD exists in. How important is it to develop, to have a community and to have support? I mean, I know it is, but I'm asking you because I want my listening audience to understand how important it is for parents in recovery to have this support all around them. I maybe I'm wrong. I think it's very important. Okay, I'm not an addiction therapist, but you know, you tell me and them if it's important.
I don't actually know anybody with successful recovery that doesn't have any form of support or community. And successful, I mean, just, you know, maintaining it and being remotely content and balanced, right? Having emotional sobriety, not feeling like your life is miserable without that substance. So the social component's huge because if you think about it, there's either two scenarios. Either the substance was used as a bonding tool to connect with people, and therefore when you remove the substance, they're left with a void because they may not have that same social bonding. So they need to connect otherwise. We're humans, right? We're social beings, and we, most of us, require some amount of human connection. The other scenario is that there is actually a disconnection that happens, and a disconnect that happens when a person is using substances. They're disconnecting from themselves, and it can get progressed to a point where they're drinking by themselves or using by themselves. And so the antithesis in the healing process for that is reconnection into a community. So there's really not a scenario I can think of where that isn't actually the solution. And there's also a healing process that happens within a group that it's inexplicable. There's nothing that you can recreate in individual therapy. There's research on it. There's something magical that happens in a group that a therapist can't reproduce because they don't, you know. I think recovery coaching is actually a wonderful field because there's a lot more shared and lived experience that goes on. It's a different type of hierarchical connection. There's like more of an equal peer lived experience interaction versus what is perceived to be a person in a position of authority. But the other piece is that group component. There's something, it's magical. I mean, I've personally been in support groups, but I've also led group therapy, and I've seen what happens. And you can't, like, you can't recreate that one-on-one, or just having a conversation or staying home all the time. I don't know anyone that's gone to you know, a meeting of their choice, because there's so many different self-help meeting options out there, and been like, ugh, I wish, you know, I wish I never went. It's kind of like exercise where you're like, it's hard to get there, but you're usually grateful that you did it.
Yeah, exactly.
So the social component is the medicine. That's mm-hmm. part of the healing, and part of the medicine for recovery and for, you know, to prevent. It's a relapse prevention tool. It's group accountability. Mm-hmm. It's feeling like you can be vulnerable within the other people have walked the walk and get right. it, that you're not just in, you know, talking to people that have never been through your experience. You also listen to people that have been through hell and back again and stayed sober, which is really powerful to hear, mm-hmm. you know, you're going through something and then you hear the story of this outrageous thing that somebody's going through, and it puts your stuff in perspective. There's something about that that is, oh, yeah. there, it's spiritual, even if you're not, you know, a spiritual person, there's, mm-hmm. there's something there, there's some life force there that, that heals.
Well, time is flying, and in these last 3 or 4 minutes, I have about 10 questions, but I'm going to limit some of those. First of all, we've been talking about your book, Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Sarah, where can one purchase the book or maintain contact with you? Do you have a blog or a website or anything? Can you share that?
My website is bentonbhc.com, and I also have a Psychology Today blog called The High Functioning Alcoholic, and my book is available on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, and roman.com, which is my publisher. Uh-huh. I also started a Facebook group called Parents in Recovery Support Group. It's very new. I'm trying to get some traction there, but I just want to start fostering some communities for parents in recovery to engage in.
Okay. What would you say, or can you say, to encourage struggling parents to take pride in their recovery? Mm-hmm. Because I think that that's something sometimes people, you know, they don't want to talk about it. There's no pride. And I think, you know, that they need to take pride in their recovery.
I agree. And that's definitely how I close my book. It's one of my favorite topics, the recovery pride movement. And, mm-hmm. you know, there was a movie called The Anonymous People by Greg Williams. And it's just a wonderful piece of work that talks about how there's so much of our society that focuses so much on addiction as this incurable and just this horrible prognosis condition, and how many people are dying of uh-huh. overdoses and all of this stuff, right? And the mm-hmm. humility and the shame and good Lord, right?
Right.
But on the flip side, there's 23 million Americans in recovery, right? So we need to celebrate those stories and hear those stories of hope. And there's at least around 7 or 8 million parents in recovery. So that's what we need to be focused on in some ways, is that there is treatment, there is solution. And also that it takes a lot of strength to admit you have an issue and to have that level of vulnerability and self-reflection, and to, interestingly enough, walk through using the addiction part of it. For many people, there's shame with it, but for some reason, and I've said this to many of my friends in recovery, why is it that the minute you admit that you have a problem or in recovery, does the shame set in? Shouldn't the yeah. shame set in? I know people feel it when they're yeah. using, but they feel it like extra when they get sober. And I'm like, mm-hmm. this is a time that, you know what I mean? This is something to be proud of. I do think, yeah.
yeah.
Right. And an outsider
should strut
sees
it,
that.
You know, you should tout it. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's hard in the beginning, especially because a lot of people have a lot of baggage that comes with it, and a lot of people they've hurt, and a lot of, you know, a lot of guilt that comes with like realizing they're sober and what happened and consequences of their actions. So it can take time to dig out from under that. But at a certain point, right, you want to be able to shift into feeling proud of the lifestyle you're living. And that's the part where I understand in the beginning where people are at most, for the most part. I do know that for some parents I interviewed, the pride kicked in pretty quickly because the shame was so great of being a parent that was using, mm-hmm. right? That when they switched into that mode, they felt finally like they were the parent they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's just, I can't emphasize it enough. I think also, you know, I'm a huge fan of anonymous programs, but I think there's an element that can happen where people just get so obsessed with anonymity that they don't ever even really tell people they're in recovery. But that's actually not what anonymity is about. Anonymity is not about saying you're in recovery. It's about identifying which particular self-help group you're in. So people confuse the two. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, saying that you're a person in recovery has absolutely nothing to do with whatever support group you're in.
Sarah, it's been real. Thank you so very much. It's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. I have been talking with Sarah Allen Benton, author of Parents in Recovery, Navigating a Sober Family Lifestyle. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your insights. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. This is Dr. Liz Hollyville inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyville. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.